Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Our lead story today is an important new development. It's a safety issue and also very scary. I'm going to be working off of the August 23rd article that appeared in the New York Times. This is lead on this is first death in a spate of vaping sicknesses reported by health officials. There have been an increasing number of vaping-related respiratory illnesses this summer. There have been 193 cases in 22 states, including 22 cases in Illinois. And researchers and officials have been stumped because they haven't found much except a common link of vaping in general amongst these patients. Now, many of these, including some in Illinois, have acknowledged vaping of tetrahydrocannabinol, THC. But officials really don't know whether the ailments are caused by marijuana-type cigarettes or whether they're caused by regular tobacco vaping cigarettes or some kind of street concoction or possibly a contaminant or even a defective device may have been involved. So public health officials are really scratching their heads. But these are serious problems. Many of the people, usually adolescents or young adults, have described difficulty breathing, chest pain, vomiting, and fatigue, and some have had such extensive lung damage that they've required treatment with oxygen and days on a ventilator, and some are thought to have persistent lung damage. We don't know what's causing this, and people have ranged from 17 to 38, so it's a pretty wide group, and I might mention again, it's 22 states. But there have been warnings and kind of cautions being raised for a while, and in fact, I raised them almost a year ago on the subject of the ingredients in the vapor, because when you heat compounds, they change. And unfortunately, with the vapes, with the e-cigarettes, you don't use up the battery when you use up the nicotine cartridge, so you can pull off the cartridge and put something else on, and there is documented growing use of unregulated bootleg or black market kinds of cannabis liquids, which are probably going to be cheaper than what can be bought where it's legal, and this is turning into a real serious Pandora's box. So because I do not know much about the process of creating THC, THC oils or extraction, I thought I would talk to a friend of mine who does know something about it. And so my friend here, who wishes to be anonymous, it should be on the air. Hi, are you there?
Hi, Dr. Dorn, I'm here.
Well, great. Thank you very much for agreeing to come on the program.
Oh, you're
and
welcome.
I think let's start with a description of good process for extracting the compounds that we want to extract, and also the pitfalls and the cautions that you take in your process.
Oh, okay. Well, I make a Rick Simpson-style oil or full extract cannabis oil, but I've also done butane and all the other shatters and waxes that people make. The only thing I can think of, when you make the oils, when I make my Rick Simpson oil, I use an alcohol, a 190 proof alcohol, as a solvent, and I boil it off. Now, the thing is, if you don't boil it off completely and you don't get rid of the solvent completely, also in butane and all those products too, I believe it can be an irritant for you. And I think if it's true that some of these people are getting this from the black market, I think that could be where that's coming from. I just spoke to my grandson who says that where he works, all the people there make their own and sell them to each other. And so I think if these people are making their own, it's a little scary, because when it comes from the manufacturer, you know, there's testing and they know what they're doing, but somebody in their basement doesn't necessarily purge it correctly. And so you can get this toxic thing. And that's kind of what I think is going on here.
You use a special device, I think, for the extraction process, or at least for the cooking off the vapors. What's involved with that? Is it like a how does it work?
Well, what it does is, because I make the full extract cannabis oil, okay, mm-hmm. So I use a countertop distiller.
Ah, okay.
And so what I do is I mix the oil and the alcohol and the cannabis together, and I sift the cannabis out, and then I take the oil and put it in this thing that boils the oil, recaptures the alcohol, and takes it down to, gets all the alcohol out. Well, I have to get the alcohol out afterwards with a second process where I put the water in it and then heat it again and to be sure that all the solvent is out. And it's a long process, and it's important to do all that.
Well, it sounds to me like that's not someone who's doing bootleg stuff in their kitchen is likely to have available. Is that right?
Well, they'll use a rice cooker.
Rice cooker? Seriously?
Yeah. Yeah, I started with a rice cooker. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well.
Yeah. It's not a good idea, though. But, there's a lot of ways of doing it. And then they use the butane, they shoot it out of these cans. And then they have to purge it afterwards. And if you don't purge it enough, again, you're going to be smoking the butane.
Right. And I understand also that there's naphtha and that some people are using rubbing alcohol when they do their extractions.
There's a lot of theories on which alcohol or which thing to use, and then people argue back and forth about it. But I use the, 190 proof ethanol just to be safe.
Right. Well, that at least is something that doesn't kill you when you drink it, at least not quickly.
Okay. Well, that's the theory anyway, yeah.
All right. Well, I was struck by what I read in the toxicology literature when you said naphtha, because when I hear naphtha, I think naphthalene, that is to say mothballs, which is a pretty toxic substance. And
well, Rick Simpson, who developed the full extract cannabis oil, had this has this video, Run from the Cure, where he shows you how to make his oil. And at that time, he used naphtha, but that was like 20 years ago.
Yeah,
and so people don't really use that anymore.
I wonder about that, but I'm also wondering about the isopropyl alcohol. What's interesting about the reactions in the case reports that have been described in this situation is that the case reports show that there's a very rapid onset of shortness of breath and gasping, choking, usually within 30 minutes. And
yeah.
And there's a case literature on naphtha as a toxin that just exactly matches that. Now, this isn't proof or evidence just because the symptoms are the same. There's going to be lots of crossover. But that really got my attention. And I also wanted to emphasize that this stuff also causes kidney failure when you are exposed to it. And and it's a neurotoxin. There's a study of where the truck, this was back in the 70s, but the tank on the truck caught a fire and it was a motor vehicle collision. So there was a whole bunch of people who got exposed to the smoke, and they had one of those situations where the emergency people get there and they've got like 20 people on the ground turning blue.
Yeah.
And they were all sort of cyanotic and hyper excited and tremulous, and one guy got cardiac arrhythmias. And so this just seems like a thing, like a children don't try this alone sort of event. And I'm remembering glue sniffing, which is basically,
the good old days.
Yeah, the good old days. Like when I was in grade school, one of my fifth grade classmates died of status epilepticus after sniffing glue. And any of the volatile solvents and all the stuff that's being used for these extractions. I sure hope that you're wearing a mask when you do or have a highly ventilated space when you're doing this, because the stuff that you're boiling off is, even though
I do it outside.
Yeah.
Do it outside.
Yeah,
that's done outside.
That's good. You're probably getting the squirrels high, but whatever.
I am. They love me out here. And I put a fan on also, even though it's outside, I put a fan on also.
Well, I want to thank you very much for coming on the show and giving us some information about best practices in the extraction process. I'm going to pivot a little bit to the e-cigarettes, but before I do that, any last words for us?
Just be safe out there. That's all. Be safe. You know, go with a product that you know. You know, don't just buy something off the street.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Have a good evening.
You too.
That was a last-minute call that I made, and she was kind enough to step in, so great thanks. This is this article about e-cigarettes. This was published in Nicotine and Tobacco Research, and it shows that the chemical flavorings that are often put in the e-cigarettes, the vanilla, the cherry, the citruses, and the cinnamons, mingle with the solvents like propylene glycol, which is antifreeze, and glycerol, and they create compounds called acetyls. And these acetyls persist in the body for a long time, and they're highly pro-inflammatory. So I'm wondering if this could be a factor in these pulmonary irritations, which are looking very much like a severe chronic severe acute inflammatory process. There's also formaldehyde that's being produced by these vape cigarettes when they work, and formaldehyde is terribly toxic. It basically cross-links the proteins, and this is how we preserve dead bodies. We make the flesh so toxic that nothing, not even a bacteria, can eat it. And, you know, we get a little bit of mold, maybe. Mold seems to be able to withstand anything. We'll have more stories about the joys of fungus later in the program. But about 40% of these flavorings convert to acetyl compounds. And about 80% of the acetyls get into the vapor. So people are actually triggering molecular receptors involved in lung irritation. So literally, we're starting to accumulate evidence that this stuff may actually be worse than smoking tobacco. And now we've seen a death, and we've got 122 people showing up with a inflammatory lung condition, which is a new disease, a new kind of presentation. So yeah, the evidence is circumstantial, but I want to see this stuff pulled off of the market until it's established that it's safe. And I think we have sufficient evidence for states to be outlawing vaping at this point until the dust settles, if you'll pardon a sort of pun. Until the dust settles and we figure out what's going on, I think this stuff needs to come off the shelves pronto. And for people who are doing their own little homegrown, stick it in your pipe and smoke it. Don't do this extraction stuff. This is looking really, really like we're introducing a whole bunch of new toxic compounds into the lungs. And, you know, the air is bad enough as it is. And now for something completely different. This just out in this week's journal, JAMA Surgery, showing that administering a readily available compound cut the volume of blood products in trauma patients in half. In other words, it kept people from going into shock very effectively. When we have someone who's, let's say, been shot in the belly with a machine gun, there's going to be bleeding. And typically what happens is they lose the contents of their arteries rather quickly and need to have their blood pressure supported. Gunshot wounds in this country are, of course, the highest cause of major trauma, with over 36,000 deaths. That's way over the annual cost for a year in the Vietnam War, by the way, at least for the American side. This is a leading cause of death. And when people have a traumatic injury, they have to be given lots of blood products pretty quickly. And sometimes if they're already in a state of severe blood loss, it can be hard to get an IV in. There is a product that is actually commercially available. It is used, ironically enough, for bedwetting. It's called arginine vasopressin. This compound has the remarkable effect of constricting the blood vessels and bringing the blood pressure back up to normal range, but it doesn't constrict the blood vessels to the vital organs. It's selective, which is way better than a lot of the drugs we use, which are variants of epinephrine. Having this available in a nasal form could make a big difference, because if the person is still breathing, you can get a dose into their bloodstream quickly, follow up with an injection once you've got a vein in. And people who were treated in a study of over 100 trauma patients had an average of 1.4 liters of blood products compared to 2.9 in those treated with placebo. And yes, it was a placebo trial. They also had a very substantially lower rate, literally two-thirds lower, of blood clots in the legs, which is a common complication of for trauma patients. And other complications and deaths were the same. So it didn't hurt anybody, and it was a substantial benefit. I hope to see further research done. I'd like to see this in every ambulance by the end of next year, because that's about the timeline it would take. This is already FDA approved. It's already commercially available. This is a slam dunk. I hope they get it out there soon. Lives are waiting to be saved. Of course, there would be another approach to reducing the number of gun violence deaths. And there's certainly been a lot of that in the news in the last few weeks. But let me just say that I'm old enough to remember before it was illegal for the CDC to research gun violence. In the late 90s, there was an initiative on the part of the American Academy of Family Physicians. And the initiative was, let's survey our patients, and just like we ask, you have a toddler, gee, have you protected the lights, the outlets with childproof outlet covers? Have you moved your prescription medicines to top drawers or high shelves? Do you have a place for people, women, to put their purses when they come into the house so the kid doesn't get into the purse? All of these questions, poisoning prevention questions. Well, lead poisoning from a bullet is another kind of prevention question that we were told to ask. We were supposed to screen for other weapons in the house. If the answer is yes, you would ask about trigger locks or other controls on access. Not judging, just asking. And this was an institution, by the way, that is located in Kansas City, Missouri. This is not a hotbed of liberalism in the 90s. It's just good common sense, proper resource, and damage prevention. So putting the vasotensin, angiopressin in there, that's good. That's a good thing to do. But it's chasing the tail. It's really not getting to the root of the problem. It's just clipping off a few weeds. We need to pull at the taproot. Our next story is about reframing the way we think about C. difficile and the microbiome in general. More and more info is showing that C. difficile, this dreadful infection related to high-dose antibiotics, is not really an infection at all. It's more of a bloom, like the red tide that occasionally provides such pretty phosphorescent colors on the waves at night and poisons our friends the surfers with a neurotoxin. So it turns out that people infected with the C. difficile pathogen who are having a problem with recurrent infections have a group of, think of it as a gang of five or six other organisms, some fungal and some bacterial, that tend to hang around in the same gut and provide a sort of protection. Like the biofilm story that we talked about last week, whether this is a biofilm or a nutritional cooperativity, it's hard to say. It hasn't been well enough studied, but there are 2 fungal and 9 bacterial species that are predictably enriched in the groups of patients with C. difficile fungus, with C. difficile infections. And Some of these fungal infections, a couple of them, are actually tied to decreases in the population of helpful bacteria. So in other words, these compounds are around, they help C. difficile persist, and they actually reduce the preventative or protective good bacteria. And it's thought that this mix of bacteria and fungus are specific, like a fingerprint, for resistant C. diff, and that in fact the resistance may be due to this absolute pattern of these, this gang of helpers that are in there. This next study, also related, comes from the July-August issue of the Journal of Family Practice, and it's from a segment called PEARLS, which stands for evidence-based clinical PEARLS. These are things that you can use that have been shown to be validated by multiple studies. In this particular case, we're talking about a review of randomized controlled trials on the use of probiotics to reduce the risk of C. difficile risk in hospitalized patients on antibiotics. So in the aggregate, they looked at over 6,261 patients taking antibiotics, and they looked to see whether they looked to see which people got what, and the probiotics doses were all over the map, from 4 billion to 900 billion, and some were started between 1 to 7 days after the first antibiotic use. The duration was 14 to 21 days, and extending for up to 2 weeks after the last antibiotic dose. Some of these were placebo-controlled trials, all but two were, and what they saw was that your risk for Clostridia difficile infection was substantially lower than in the control group. The most important thing about this, I guess, is where the confidence interval ended up, which was at the 0.042, and the range on that confidence interval. This is statistical stuff, but basically it means how noisy was the data, how likely is this to be due to chance. And the confidence interval was really good at a range of 0.3 to 0.57. That's quite good. The number needed to treat, 43. So if 43 people go into the hospital and get antibiotics and they all get probiotics, then the person who is one person will be prevented from the C. difficile infection, which cuts the frequency of C. difficile infection compared to control by about, 300%. So yes, that's important. That's worth doing. And it shows how there's this great amount of interaction and change that's taking place in the system, in the gut. It's a very dynamic rainforest-like ecosystem with all sorts of bird calls and other things going on that in each one influences the other. I just finished reading a book about how all other wild animals listen to the bird calls, because that tells them about predators in the area and how the birds themselves have different calls depending upon whether the animal is a predator or a competitor or a harmless bystander. It was a fascinating book, and it had a lot of wonderful bird calls because I live in Bird Valley down here in North Monterey County, so it's wonderful to be able to decode those bird calls and understand what they mean, which I now do quite frequently. The microbiome is tweeting and chirping and talking to all of the other entities, plus feeding them, just in the same way that chickens peck at cow poop to get at the bugs, which they eat. That's the kind of thing that is going on in this ultra-rich pasture that we carry around in our intestines. Now, just to make things more interesting, we have a caller who wants to talk about the microbiome. Hello, you're on the air. This is Jess in Santa Cruz. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah, before I ask my question, I just thought I'd mention there was a cartoon in the New Yorker, I think it was a real recent issue. It's a woman in the doctor's office, and the doctor is saying to her, you should try the probiotics now before we find out they don't make any difference.
Well, you know, they wish. I do think that it's very true that we've done studies where you can take probiotics and you can bake them in a microwave, so you can kill all the bugs. And the dead cell walls of the probiotics still have an anti-diarrheal effect. So I typically, if someone goes traveling now, they're like doing, you know, whatever, they're going to a place where I think they might get traveler's diarrhea, I'll send them with a bottle of probiotics, and I'll tell them to take about 200 billion organisms every 4 hours if they start to get diarrhea. And it knocks out the diarrhea better than Cipro and Imodium, which was my old standby for travel medicine. I don't give Cipro out anymore because of the tendon issues, which have emerged as a major side effect, particularly for people who are out there traveling and hefting luggage. I don't want them blowing out a shoulder tendon because I gave them something for their traveler's diarrhea. The reports I've been getting from my patients for up to a decade now on the probiotics for this purpose is, you know, two thumbs up. So I'm feeling like, yeah, even if the bacteria are dead, there's still signaling compounds in their cell wall that have a beneficial effect on the organism. But please go on with your question, Jess.
Well, my question was, you've been talking about the gut microbiome.
Mm-hmm.
And I was curious about the skin microbiome. I've been reading some articles recently, mostly on The Guardian. I think one of the articles was titled, I Don't Stink.
Right, and right. I caught that.
People who, okay, they give up showers because, as they say, it interferes with the skin microbiome. So I was just curious about your thoughts on that.
Yes, and I can tell you what the gist is. I learned about this maybe 3 years ago at a conference. Someone that had a booth, and they were selling a line of products called Mother Dirt. And I thought, oh, that's it. You know, Mother Earth, Mother Dirt. And what they, what their hypothesis or argument was that there is a natural group of bacteria that eat ammonia. And the ammonia is what makes our sweat stink and what makes our bodies stink. And so if you could colonize the skin with ammonia-eating bacteria and get a good solid colony of those and a nice nice biofilm on the surface of your skin so that you could use some kind of rinsing. You know, he was talking about how the guy in the Guardian interview, I was quoted as saying when he, if he gets his leg dirty, he washes off that part of the leg, but he doesn't use soap all over his body on general principle. And I don't know if he is the Mother Dirt guy or if this is a different person because I'm not good with names. And the point is, this appears to be a thing and some people are willing to do it. And I would have deep concerns if my doctor was doing it because of the possibility of transferring pathogens. Back, there was this guy named Semmelweis. You might have heard of him. And back in the ancient times, doctors would wear these coats, and they would wear the same coat all day, and they were delivering babies, and then they were going back to the hospital, and they would have all this blood and gore, and it was kind of it wasn't considered to be a problem to walk around with other people's blood and gore and poop on your thing. It just showed you were a hardworking doctor. Anyway, this guy Semmelweis said, I wonder if the reason we have such an epidemic of women dying of uterus infections is because we aren't cleaning ourselves and we're transferring the infection from patient to patient. This is back right after the invention of the microscope. So people have figured out that there are these little bugs in pond water that seem to be alive. And there's the emergence of this concept of maybe some of these are pathogenic and could cause disease, but it's still a tough Semmelweis is right where I feel like we are with the probiotics, where he's making this argument and there's data to support it. And to us, it looks obvious from, you know, the perspective of 200 years later. But to them, it's like, oh, that's ridiculous. Everybody knows that diseases are caused by bad humors and, you know, that liver disease is caused by being angry all the time. I mean, these are given. These go back to Galen. Everybody knows this stuff. changing people's models is hard. So I'm just copying to my own prejudice, which is I'm going to wash my hands between patients. And
it's not it's a question of hygiene in those circumstances. But I was from what I gist of it that I got was that there are natural lubricants on the skin, also as well as bacteria that are also destroyed by showering every day.
Absolutely,
and, especially using hot water, so that avoiding a shower, a daily shower, can be beneficial for helping the skin heal or prevent it from developing eczema or other conditions.
And removing oil with grease with some other form of clean oil probably also doesn't affect the lipid bilayer, which is a really important, that lipid layer is very important to the health of the skin. So, and I'm sure it's also food for the right bacteria. So essentially, if you want to cultivate a good microbiome with lots of ammonia-eating bacteria, you probably have to leave that oil on there to give them something besides ammonia to eat, because I can't imagine that ammonia all by itself is an adequate diet even for a growing bacteria, you know?
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you so much for your comprehensive answer, and I look forward to the rest of your show.
Thank you for an intriguing question, and keep listening. Bye-bye. So getting back to this complex signaling and complex interactions, recent research has just come out of the University of Queensland in Australia. These researchers, now Yue Wang is the chief researcher, they've discovered that different species of bacteria that are known to swap information, including antibiotic resistance. We've known that for a long time. That happens in the gut all the time. They found that commonly used drugs increase the chances that this genetic swapping, otherwise known as conjugation, is taking place. What's actually going on is kind of fascinating and a little sexy. One of the bacteria, let's call it an E. coli, will extrude a tubular thing called a pili, and then it'll shoot a circular bit of DNA through the pili that contains the information for how to resist penicillin. And then the bacteria that gets touched by the pili and has that inserted, which, by the way, can be a different species. They don't seem to mind. They're pretty indiscriminate there. They'll trade around drug resistance information. Now, what this study showed, that the anti-inflammatories ibuprofen, naproxen, diclofenac, and the lipid-lowering drug gemfibrozil and the beta-blocker propranolol were studied, and they also studied iprobide, which is a X-ray contrast agent. What they found was that when they incubated two strains of bacteria, one which was resistant to three types of antibiotic and the other which was resistant to a different fourth type of antibiotic, and they mixed those two in the test tube, and they waited to see if they got any bacteria that could now resist all four antibiotics. So after 8 hours in the control mixtures, which didn't contain any of the drugs, no four antibiotic resistant bugs emerged. And the contrast material didn't do it. But quadruple-resistant bacteria did emerge after exposure to ibuprofen, naproxen, diclofenac, gemfibrozil, and propranolol. And this was even at very, very low concentrations. We're talking 0.005 milligrams per liter, which is well below the amount that would be in your bloodstream if you were taking one of these agents for therapeutic purposes. They don't quite know how this worked. They think it may have been linked to signaling that's made it easier for the bacteria to release and absorb each other's DNA, but they don't have the microscopic evidence of exactly how that happened. But that happened, given that of the drugs I've mentioned, three of them are over-the-counter, and the lipid-lowering drug is a fairly commonly prescribed agent, and propranolol, the beta blocker, is practically ubiquitous in the over 50 population. So, wow, more issues with drugs and interactions with the microbiome, but this in a completely, at least to me, unexpected way. My next two stories relate to maternal child health. Last week, we introduced this concept of exosomes, which are little excreted balls of cell membrane that contain compounds. And it's something that we've known exists and that we've been using sometimes for drug delivery. You've probably heard of liposomal vitamins, and this is where the compound is inserted into a fat ball. The thing about the fat ball, if it's compatible with the cell membrane, it will fuse with the cell membrane. And in the process of fusion, its contents are dumped inside the cell. So you can get around the problem of something that doesn't mix with oil or that's water soluble getting in. The old oil and water don't mix conundrum makes it hard for many molecules to penetrate cells without some kind of active assistance. During pregnancy, there is a constant communication between the maternal and the fetal cells using exosomes. The fetal exosomes signal to the mother's body when the organs have fully matured, and so these, hey, I'm ready, I'm baked, exosomes trigger the labor and delivery process. The researchers used mice that were genetically engineered to have certain exosome proteins glow fluorescent red and green, and then they tracked fetal exosomes traveling to the maternal side, and they found that they could find these by drawing blood from the mother and looking for fetal exosomes. Now the traveling of the exosomes from the maternal side to the fetus produces functional changes, and I'm wondering if some of the epigenetics that we see in situations of high anxiety or food shortage, the classic Dutch hunger study that we've talked about so many times on this program, where if your mother's starved, when you're born, you're more likely to get diabetes or hypertension or obesity because you're born hungry, effectively, and your cells are born to hold on to all the calories they possibly can. It probably turns on brown fat. We'll talk more about brown fat later this program or next week if we don't get to it. But they could also use fake exosomes and target them to put them in the maternal bloodstream and then have them transfer to the fetus. And they were able to prevent preterm delivery, which is often related to fetal inflammation. That's why when a mom in the third trimester gets an infection, even a bladder infection, it's likely to trigger preterm labor. Inflammation is basically like a fire drill. Better get the baby out before mother dies of sepsis. Even if it's not quite baked, there it has a chance. This is an adaptive survival thing in the jungle, or the savannah, but here in the first world, at least, it's maladaptive as hell, and it's a major problem with our, well, it's, you can imagine, inflammation's more common in people who are stressed and more common in people who aren't eating a healthy diet, who aren't getting their vegetables, who are maybe using substances that might themselves be inflammatory, like most of the injectable drugs. We've got a real epidemic of preterm birth going on right now. And this might be a way, although, of course, social justice would be a better way, to fix it. I promised you two stories on maternal child health. This next one is about pomegranate juice. Now, before we go any further, I do want to tell you that this study was supported by the NIH, the foundation of Barnes Jewish Hospital, and an unrestricted gift from Palm Wonderful, who make all the pomegranate juice on the planet. So they had definite skin in the game in this being an effective study, but this was done at Brigham and Women's Hospital, and it was peer-reviewed, and what the research showed is preliminary findings from a clinical trial of expectant mothers whose babies were diagnosed with intrauterine growth retardation. IUGR is a condition where either the placenta is not quite right or there's inflammation and the baby isn't growing as quickly as you would expect. When a baby in the womb measures small for its gestational age, it's a real problem. The process of birth also reduces oxygen to the baby's brain, and there are babies born with hypoxic brain damage, effectively a birth stroke from not getting enough oxygen during labor. These can affect brain development, as you might imagine, and what we know from previous epidemiologic studies is that babies who have IUGR are more likely to have problems with dyslexia, problems with processing. If you look at the brains on the ones that don't make it, you find microstructural and connectivity differences from similar gestational age in infants. This study looked, as I said, at babies who were diagnosed at 24 to 43 weeks. The moms were randomized to receive 8 ounces of pomegranate juice daily, or a liquid that didn't have any polyphenols in it that tasted and looked and had the same number of calories. The researchers did not observe changes in brain macrostructure. That is to say, when you look at an MRI, this brain shape and size of the big structures was the same. But when they looked at white matter microstructural and functional connectivity, they saw improvement in basically the cabling between the various brain structures. So the visual development of the brain and the blood flow and the cabling were all better. And this is, I can't imagine doing functional MRI in human infants, but they managed to do it. So what can I say? Better living through pomegranate juice? Maybe. It's also got some good stats for prevention of heart disease and cancer. And those red polyphenols, man, they're pretty powerful stuff. I mean, look at the flamingos. While on the topic of functional MRI, this is the first I've seen of using functional MRI as a treatment paradigm. This time we're treating Tourette's syndrome. Now, if you're not familiar, Tourette's syndrome is classified as a tic disorder. There are repetitive movements and vocalizations that are involuntary, but can be suppressed. However, suppressing it is like trying to suppress a sneeze. The urge gets bigger and bigger until finally the person has an outburst, often of some stereotypical movement or a repetitive phrase. I had a friend in college with Tourette syndrome, and you know the 7 forbidden words? Well, her verbal tic had 3 of them in it, which made her socially, well, unpopular in college because, well, you can imagine the circumstances. And you've probably seen people in one with Tourette's and wondered if they're crazy. No, they're not. They just have a tic disorder, similar to stuttering in a way, and certainly similar to facial tics that we often see when the brain is under development. Fortunately, Tourette syndrome usually improves as you get into your 20s, but there are still people suffering with it. In this study, they took people with Tourette syndrome from 11 to 19 who had a certain frequency, and they were given basically a feedback using EEG. So an EEG lead that was placed over a part of their brain called the supplementary motor area. And it's near the back of the brain. It's associated with tics. And what they did was show them a real-time graph and ask them to raise and then lower activity in this part of the brain, show them when they did it, didn't tell them how to do it, because you have to learn on your own when it comes to biofeedback, brain biofeedback. But they had a control group in this study who had a similar EEG load and a similar task to do, but it was not affecting that area of the brain. What they showed was that specifically learning to control that part of the brain was very helpful in treating Tourette's symptoms. Didn't require pharmaceuticals, and so a So it shows that we may be able to help people with Tourette's using simple biofeedback, and that is really exciting. More studies, this one using EEG, which is a very, very basic technology available in every hospital in the country, may have found a way of measuring autism and identifying it at a very early age. This is a nonverbal marker. It shows that individuals with autism are slower to dampen neural activity in response to visual signals to the brain. So a non-invasive screening thing would be fabulous. You're 18 months or older before you have any chance, really, of being diagnosed with autism. And we've known for a long time that they have hypersensitivity to sensory input, including differences in processing visual information. Some of the stereotypical things that you see in people with autism are as if their brain is too loud and they're seeking to reduce the amount of input. In a normally operating human brain, when you present two different images at the same time, the images rock back and forth in awareness, toggling between the left and the right eye. So researchers had previously demonstrated that the autistic brain is slower in switching from one image to the next. This is also called technically binocular rivalry. But they have differences in inhibiting neural transmission, so it's harder for them to turn off the signal in the right eye and switch their awareness to the left. The neurotransmitter GABA is involved. This new study used brain imaging to measure the slower rate of binocular rivalry, and they used a single EEG, as I said earlier, put it on the occipital part of the head over the visual region. That's the back. When you're lying on your flat on your back, you're pressing against your visual, or you're pressing against the skull that's immediately above the visual cortex. So they had red checkerboard on the left eye and green checkerboards on the right, and they flickered back and forth at different rate. It was able to measure how well people could do the shift, and they found this is also in just little kids that you're showing a screen and showing them these images and flashing them. It had an 87% accuracy in identifying autism. There was a slower rate of the switching from one image to the other, and this is the best nonverbal marker of autism. This is a type of screen that potentially could be done in very young children, and it's a screen that could be done routinely or readily at hospitals with a plug-in extra device. So super, super interesting, and I hope a real step forward, because what else our research tells us is that the earlier that we start engaging people with autism in behavioral modification strategies and essentially a different learning environment, we have to create a learning environment that matches the brain, not expect the brain to match to the learning environment. People who do not have autism can match their brain, for the most part, to the learning environment, although there's always, you know, people who have hearing processing differences or visual processing differences or dyslexia who find themselves at a disadvantage. But it's extraordinarily cool to think that we may be taking a stride forward in early diagnosis, and I'm happy to be the first to share it with you, because I have not seen this as front page news, although maybe it should be. It's always good to end on something a little salacious. This is about parasite sex in cat intestines. I'm talking, of course, about your friend and mine, toxoplasmosis, the reason that pregnant women are discouraged from changing boxes of kitty litter. The toxoplasmosis bacteria parasite is interesting in that the only organism that the parasite can complete its life cycle is the cat. The sexual phase of the parasite's life cycle requires linoleic acid. This is a nutrient that's found in uniquely high levels in cats because cats have a mutation. They lack the enzyme for breaking it down. Just like people with lactose intolerance lack the enzyme to break down milk sugar and get farting and diarrhea if they eat milk, these cats don't break down linoleic acid, which is a which is an omega that's found in all kinds of things. It's an omega 6, I believe, if I haven't gotten that backwards. I always get linoleic and linolenic backwards. But where it is at high levels, the only mammalian intestine where it is, it allows the toxoplasmosis to form gametes, in other words, sperm and eggs. Otherwise, the parasite has to reproduce by fission like a bacteria, and it doesn't reproduce as effectively, and it can't evolve. Yes, I'm right. It is an omega-6. The enzyme in question is called delta-6 desaturase, and it catalyzes the conversion of linoleic acid to arachidonic acid. And so when you eat, like for example, when you eat flax, you get quite a bit of linoleic acid, and you get quite a lot of arachidonic acid, but you also get some healthy omega-6 that balances it out, which is why flax is kind of a health food. I'm getting a field here. Bottom line is, the cool thing about parasites is they have this really elaborate life cycle. Some of them go through 3 or 4 species, and it creates a kind of unique, non-competitive environment. We've scratched our head since we first started figuring this out at the beginning of the 20th century about why on earth do these parasites go through this stuff. Well, my hypothesis is that it keeps the competition out because no one can follow in your trail, so you've got a unique marketing niche, but there might be other reasons. Stay tuned. If some emerge, you'll hear it right here. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.